Welcome to the Power of the Purse podcast, the only show connecting women professionals to their peers. This isn't just about money. This is about life. And now the host of the Power of the Purse podcast, Lynn S. Evans.
Good afternoon, everyone. My name is Lynn S. Evans, and I am the host of Power of the Purse podcast. There was a time in my life not too long ago when I believed three things about money. One, women are not supposed to talk about or be included in any conversations about money. Two, women don't have the natural ability to understand anything about money. And three, men know best how to manage money. And those truths I made up about money guided me for years until I realized money was not a foreign language or some other obscure academic exercise. And it was something I could not only understand, but teach to other women. Too many times I've heard stories from women who ought to know better but didn't until they were forced to because of divorce, widowhood, job loss, or the approach of retirement. This podcast will add another chapter to an ongoing informative conversation about financial topics women should be more knowledgeable about. My mission is to help women reduce their financial illiteracy and develop a healthy relationship with money. With that in mind, my guest today is Amy Goyer. She is an author, speaker, and consultant specializing in aging and families, including caregiving, grandparenting, and multi-generational issues. She has authored numerous publications, including the books AARP's Juggling Work and Caregiving and Things to Do Now That You're a Grandparent. She is also a recognized media authority, and she's been interviewed for TV, online, and print media, including ABC, NBC, CBS, NPR, The Doctors, The New York Times, The Washington Post, People Magazine, and numerous state and local newspapers and television stations. She's been an advocate for older adults, children, and families for more than 30 years at the local, state, national, and international levels. She started her career as a music therapist and adult day services administrator and later worked at the Ohio Department of Aging before joining AARP, where for 15 years she led the intergenerational and grandparenting programs, including the Grandparent Information Center, a leading resource for grandparent caregivers. Welcome, Amy.
Thank you so much. It's a great pleasure to be with you today.
And there's just so much for us to talk about. But the first one I wanted to speak with you about is something that struck me when I read that introduction a while ago. And that is because so many baby boomer women started their careers in a field they left behind many years ago, myself included. I'm curious to know how and why you made the transition from music therapist to adult day services administrator, and then as a writer with AARP. It's a stunning transition on the face of it, but I'm sure in your life it was somewhat of a logical one. So tell us about that.
Yes, it's so interesting. I remember my dad used to tell me that people change careers plus or minus five times during their lifetime, and for me, To me, as you say, it seems like a direct path, and it all makes total sense. But I guess if you look at it from music therapist to what I'm doing now, you might wonder. As you said, I started my career out as a music therapist, and my first job out of college was in adult daycare center that was also affiliated with a nursing home. And so I was activities director and did all music therapy and other activities. And, you know, in a small staffed organization, you start to do all kinds of things. And I started getting more into the administrative end of things. We opened a couple of new adult daycare centers, and I ended up just moving more into an administrative role, still doing music therapy, but you know, managing and supervising staff and all of that. So after doing that for about 6 years, I kind of wanted something new, a new challenge, et cetera, and I went to work for the Ohio Department of Aging. And again, it was a logical transition because I had this practical on-the-ground, local-level experience, and they were looking for someone to be a field representative to liaison with the area agencies around the state, provide training and expertise, monitor the Older Americans Act funds, which I was familiar with from that viewpoint in terms of receiving mm-hmm. those funds. And also, they wanted someone to be a lead on intergenerational programming and adult daycare. And so those were things I had a great deal of experience with, because in working in the adult daycare center, we had a philosophy, very intergenerational approach. So we did a lot with children and youth, and intergenerational programming had grown to be a huge love of mine, and I very strong belief in it. So it was actually the perfect and most logical next step. And then years later, when they were going to working for the state government, the governor changes, everything changes, that sort of thing.
Yep.
So the new governor wasn't as interested in doing the intergenerational work, and they were changing that. And I, had so loved it by that point that I looked for another job doing something similar. And it led me to Washington, D.C., and AARP, who was looking for someone to do their intergenerational work, as well as had older adult learning, and I had done a lot with that at the state and senior volunteer programs. That had been part of my work at the state as well. And so, again, it was a logical step. What happened over the years with AARP is that, I moved into doing the grandparenting and the other type of work, and that's where personal life experience starts to interact with your career, because mm-hmm. I began having, I had been a caregiver my entire adult life because my parents moved from Ohio to Arizona when I was a sophomore in college, and my grandparents all lived in Indiana, and I'm the youngest of four girls, and yet this was my field, so I was really, into it and knew what to do to help my grandparents. So I'd taken on a more active role in their care. My grandmother, my dad's mom had Alzheimer's disease, and my dad's an only child, so we had a lot to do with that. So when I moved to Washington, by that time, my mom had had a stroke. She was only 63 when she had a stroke. My wow. grandparents passed away within a year or two of my moving to D.C., but began taking more of a long-distance role, helping my dad with my mom, and my mom couldn't drive, and she couldn't cook, and there were certain things she couldn't do, so he was very busy. He was a chair of the communication department at Arizona State University. So my sisters and I all, pitched in at different times. Over the years, my dad started to develop Alzheimer's disease, and so we started doing more and more care and support, and I became his power of attorney and my mom's, and it just was taking more and more. My sister, who lived near them, was really struggling and needed more help. And so that's why I left AARP. And interestingly, when I left AARP as a full-time employee, they kept me on contract to do some writing for the website. I also worked for another website, grandparents.com, for about 6 months. Then they laid me off. So that was a big shocker. But my colleagues at AARP said, okay, great, we're going to put you on a larger contract. We need you anyway to do more of our media communications. I had already started writing when I was a full-time employee for the website, so I was doing more of that. And it just, I moved to Arizona to take care of my parents, and as my caregiving part of my personal life grew, the need for it in terms of the national stage and what AARP needed and the spokesperson that they needed, et cetera, just came together perfectly. So that's a very long way of explaining to you that.
No, but
I think, it all makes total sense. What I'm doing now is literally combines every bit of my career and my personal life to date, as a music therapist. You learn to identify problems, And in that set, you use music to achieve non-musical goals. So I was trained to look at what are the issues. And I've worked at the local level. I know home and community-based services very well, both from the practitioner standpoint and from, you know, the administrative standpoint in terms of the state overseeing the funds, et cetera. So I know the systems so well that it comes together perfectly for me to be able to help other family caregivers.
Did you, when you were younger, you said that your mom and dad lived in, well, they moved when you were in college. But before that, did you live in a multi-generational home?
I did not, no. I never lived in a multi-generational home myself. My mom did. Her grandfather lived with her. But I never did myself. So I now, though, fast forward many years later, at one time my sister got divorced and she and her daughter moved in with my parents, so I experienced it from that viewpoint. Mm-hmm. And then just recently, my another sister and her two sons moved from Ohio to Arizona to help take care of dad, and we all lived together for a year. And then the house next door came open for rent, so they now live next door, which is just perfect.
Yeah, that sounds great. The reason I'm asking you that question is because obviously you were kind of thrown into that situation where you had responsibilities for grandparents and then parents. But I grew up in a household where I lived with my grandparents and my mom and dad and my two other siblings. So for the longest time, I didn't know of anything else. I mean, to me, it always was multigenerational. Mm-hmm. And it occurred to me when I was reading this information about your background that that is such an anomaly in today's world. I mean, we don't do that anymore, you know, because like you said, your parents left and went to Arizona. That happens a lot. Parents retire to someplace other than where they raise their families. And then
they actually my parents moved to Arizona while they were still working. My dad moved there for a job. Yeah.
Okay.
But they had an almost empty nest at that point.
Yeah, I guess so. And that's my point, is that we move around for things that a generation ago, we just wouldn't do things like that. It was a rarity. You just stayed where you grew up. You know, it was just one of those things. Mm-hmm. And now I realize that just about everybody in my generation, as a baby boomer, their children are not anywhere near them. They may be 2 hours away, but they're not there. I am the only
one
of my three siblings who stayed in the city where I was born and raised. The other two have been gone for more than 30-some years. So I think that's very traditional, the way that's how it works anymore. So given that... How do you, what are some of the resources that you say are available short of moving to where your parents are to take care of them? And I know that the resources that are available on the AARP site are phenomenal, but tell us about some of those resources that are out there. How do you deal with this when your job, your world is 8 hours away from mom and dad and you still feel an obligation to do something?
Right. Well, first of all, I just want to, again, say, as you say, we're a very mobile society. And while it's interesting, in some ways, the multi-generational living is still a very big topic, especially with certain racial ethnic groups, it's much more common to be living all in one household. So there is an actually very important element of that in our country. Hispanic families are more likely to be living in multi-generational households, as are African-American households. So it's something that still does happen, even though it seems like it hasn't happened since World War II, right?
Yeah.
But there are some. But you're right that there are many, many long-distance family caregivers. And as you heard from my story, I've done both. I've been long-distance, and I've been live-in caregiver. And my life right now is I am both, because as I'm talking to you right now, I'm in my home in the Washington, D.C. area. I come here once a month. I kept my place here because my work is based here, and I go back and forth. So I kind of get both experiences, you know, of being there hands-on, living with my dad, providing a lot of hands-on care, to coordinating things from a distance and trying to stay in touch and keep up with what he's doing. So you're right. There are resources now. And I think technology has changed the caregiving experience more than anything, and especially in terms of long-distance family caregiving. Yes. It really has made it so much more possible to keep track of everything. I mean, even just the fact that we can accomplish a lot on the phone. You know, you can you can talk to doctors and do everything else. Most of the time, it doesn't matter where you are. You actually are living there as it is. The key thing is to still have someone on the ground there who is your eyes and ears. So if you're a long-distance family caregiver, you have to create some sort of on-the-ground team, and that might be friends, neighbors, volunteers, paid staff who come and help your loved ones. You know, even the mail carriers tend to get, can be sort of a first, oh, something's not right, they're not picking up their mail, or, you know, there's a lot of ways to look at that. And geriatric care managers are a growing profession. They changed their national association to be called Aging Life Care Specialists. But, you know, what they can do is sort of that local management on the ground role for you. So that's one thing that I really highly recommend, that you still have someone who can go and check on your loved ones. When I was traveling, when I first went out to Arizona, my parents were still a little bit more independent. I had someone who was a concierge who helped me out with a variety of things. And I would just have her go check on my parents, go see them, because sometimes you can't tell over the phone how they're really doing. You know, so
yes, exactly.
It's important to be able to see them. But do you use technology? So I have now video cameras that are set up. And last night my dad, Alzheimer's is more advanced. And so he does not actually, he has some visual perceptual issues. So he doesn't really look at the television, and he talking on a video screen would not work for him. But I can see him, which I love. And we, you know, converse on that. There is the smart home technology now is just unbelievable. And every day someone sends me some new caregiving application that they've put together. For example, you could set up a lock on your parents' front door that is programmable, that you can program from a distance. You can have a video camera there. And if you have someone coming in 3 days a week to help them with bathing, you can program that lock so that that person has their own unique code, and it only works between, you know, 1 and 2 p.m. on Monday, Wednesday, and Friday, so that you can control that. You can check to see who it is when they're coming in, and you could unlock the door from a distance. So, you know, that's one way to do it. It's just amazing how much you can do when you're a long-distance family caregiver that way.
That is amazing. I didn't know that.
Yeah,
I knew about the video. Yeah, I knew about the videos. You know, the cameras. I understood that, but that the ability to program a lock through the internet like that is amazing.
Yeah, and control the air conditioning and the heating and open and close the blinds. All of those things, you could do that from a distance, as well as a really important aspect of personal safety, you know, medical alert systems and medication monitors. You can have some technology that will let you know if your mom and dad took their medicine out of the medicine organizer, things like that.
Mm-hmm. That's amazing. Where would this information be? Is this on the AARP website?
AARP has a lot of really great information on the family caregiving site, and that's just www.aarp.org/caregiving. And if you go there, we have just a plethora of information, articles. I write a column on the site. We have information about, you know, caregiving basics, how to do things if you're caring for someone at home, dealing with health issues, finances and legal, which I know is your big topic, and resources, how to get connected in the community, and especially caregiver life balance, which, you know, is about taking care of ourselves as a caregiver so we have the energy to keep going.
And I say to that, when am I supposed to find the time to do that?
I know.
I know everybody says it, and I know they mean well. But it's just so hard to find the time to do that for you, and without the guilt, I should say. You know,
believe
that's the hard
me,
part.
I know.
I know.
Well, you know what I tell caregivers? It's not selfish. It's just practical. And I'll tell you my philosophy on this. So I literally, this happened to me. I went to get gas in my car, and my car was, you know, running on fumes. It was just empty. Yeah. And I was holding my breath that I'd make it to the gas station. And I filled up the car. And as I pulled away, I thought to myself, wow, you know, it's interesting. When it has a full tank of gas, it actually runs differently. I can tell a difference in how the car runs when it has gas. And then I had to laugh at myself. Well, duh, right? But it was one of those aha moments where I thought, Yeah. That's me. I'm expecting myself to run just as efficiently on empty. And I'm not, I can't run efficiently on empty any more than my car can. And that really changed things for me. Because it's very practical. You have to put fuel in order to give out. So you have to build your energy in order to be able to do things and give it out, give to others. So I look at it as kind of a variety of things with this car analogy in terms of quick fill-ups. Like most of the time that we as caregivers have to fill our own tanks is going to be 5-10 minutes. Because as you say, when do you have time to do it? When you're caregiving, and I know you're a caregiver. So you have to find things that you can do often with your loved ones while you're caregiving. And it might be making a cup of coffee or going quickly on social media and checking in with friends and family or texting someone or calling a friend. For me, sometimes it's just doing some jumping jacks that kind of revs up and fills my tank a little bit, gets my energy going, or music is clearly a big thing for me and our family, and my dad loves music too. And we might do something like just burst into song as we're walking down the hall, and then that changes the mood for everyone. Yeah. And so those are the quick tank fillers, but you also have to have your premium fill-ups, and that's going to be a little more time. So in terms of going to a movie and taking a class, going to a support group, I go to Pilates once a week. That's my thing. try to get done. And sometimes that's while you're with your loved ones. Like, do you ever watch movies with your husband? Or do we, you know, my dad loves musicals. So we choose things that kind of fill both of our tanks at the same time. Or I used to always take my parents out on Fridays for a fun Friday adventure, and mom would get her hair done, and then we go out to eat or go to the mall and walk around or do something, you know, and that wasn't always easy to do, but it still filled my tank and theirs and kind of met that need. And then you need to have your tune-ups, so you have to have time away when you're not taking care of anyone. Mm-hmm. And that's the hardest, isn't it?
I was just going to say that is the hardest part.
That's the hardest one, to get a chunk of time, but at least 3 or 4 days, if not a week. I really find that I at least twice a year I try to take some time off. But again, that's hard to do, but you try to prioritize it, because I do think that's about the time when you fully reboot. You know, you have to not be focused on taking care of anybody. And then your routine maintenance. So for me, my top priority is sleep, because I can't do anything. You know, if I'm exhausted, I don't have the ability to cope. And then, you know, exercise, eating healthy foods. I recently went, you know, I, like every other family caregiver, gained 20, 30 pounds. And so I just started changing the way I eat and cutting out sugar and certain things. And I've lost some weight and I feel a whole lot better. I have more energy to be doing what I'm doing. So these things make sense, but looking at it in a practical way kind of helps alleviate that guilt every time you do something for yourself.
Yeah, it does. But I want to go back to something you said, because I think that this is really a wonderful idea if I could find one of these people. You mentioned geriatric care managers and concierge. Where does one find people like that?
So the first one, in terms of a concierge, This is kind of a booming profession that I see creeping up everywhere, because it's people who are independent and they want to work, but they can control their work a bit. And so they it's almost kind of like an odd job, or what was the My Girl Friday or something, isn't that a movie? Where they just you do whatever. And I found mine because I wanted someone to check on my house when I had to go out of town and to get my mail and sort it, et cetera. So I went online and I Googled, you know, I was just searching. I think I put in house sitting, and Debbie, mm-hmm. my concierge, came up. Her business is the White Glove Concierge, and she described on her website the variety of things she could do, from pet sitting to house sitting to helping with events to running errands. And so I called her, and I don't know what I would have done without her for the past 8 years. She really has done a little bit of everything, and early on she would just go check on my parents, and there have been times when they didn't need as much intense hands-on care, where she's actually, you know, spent a few hours with them while I did things, so kind of a respite. But she helps me put up decorations when, like, it's important to me to have Christmas decorations up, but I don't have time to do it. She runs errands. Right now, as I said, I'm in D.C. this week. When I come back, she will have sorted all the mail for me. We have a system of how we divide up Dad's mail and my mail and everything so that I don't come back to a huge stack of mail. She picks me up at the airport. You know, she does such a variety of things. So if you go online and kind of start searching around, you'll find people like this. I know here in my community here in D.C., there are several people I've come across who are doing it. You might look also at, like, personal assistant is another term that sometimes people use. And FYI, I've found that often it's more cost effective to pay her to do something to free me up so I can do things for mom and dad. So it's actually sometimes more cost effective to have someone take care of those things that I don't necessarily have to be the one to do, but I do need to take my dad to a doctor's appointment. You know what I mean?
Yeah, I was just going to say that that's an important distinction, because there are certain things that others can do for you. But I think with my husband, whenever there is a doctor's appointment, I want to make sure I'm there, because the issue is he doesn't remember half of what his experiences are, or the things that he's doing or not doing. And so you need another person there to help with the physician to understand what are the symptoms, if you want to call it that. And I think it's great, but the geriatric care manager, is that somebody who
that's kind of a different thing,
all of that?
Yeah, so the geriatric care managers are able to do, in some ways they're able to be you, and they kind of can serve a role as a care coordinator and help you find services, help monitor things like that. In an emergency, they could go to, I had one lined up in Phoenix for a while, who, if I was worried that, you know, somebody would have to go to the hospital and I would be too far away to do that.
Yeah.
And so she was on call, kind of. She was familiar with our situation, and if need be, I could call on her. You might have someone who is able to do monitoring kind of checks. So if you're at a distance and or your loved one is getting a care, someone needs to be checking on that and making sure the care is actually happening, that it's happening in the quality level that you want it to be, whether they're in a facility or receiving home care. And they could be that person that checks on that. Generally, they are, you know, stay up on the medications and all of that sort of thing that they're in. They could go to a doctor's appointment. So it's kind of I think of it as kind of cloning myself as a caregiver, you know, as closely as you can, someone who's able to play that role. And you can find one, again, their national association is called the Aging Life Care Specialist. So they have a website, and you can go on there and do some searching to find someone, or you could look locally as well.
Okay. As far as the music is concerned, that was something that intrigued me, because I know that there's been so much research done and proved that people with any form of dementia respond extremely well to music, and that it's one of those things that really helps them maintain a certain equilibrium, helps them to have some sense of pleasure, and they get lost in it on purpose, which is a good thing. But how do you, I know that when my husband and I go to, we have tickets for a theater group that they bring in Broadway shows, and maybe we see four or five of them over the course of 6 or 7 months. And he always looks forward to that, and most especially the musicals, for the obvious reason. So I'm just wondering, how do you incorporate music into the caregiving that you have for your loved ones without it looking like it's therapy per se. But mm-hmm. is there some way to get people engaged in a kind of a matter-of-fact way, even though you know what you're doing with it?
Yes.
But it helps
right.
them to get engaged in the idea of either listening to, or if they did play an instrument, that if that's long-term memory, then it should be able to come back. If they, let's say, play guitar, piano, something like that. Is that
mm-hmm.
true?
Yeah, so it varies according to the person. In some ways, those skills often are the ones that last the longest, the music mm-hmm. Abilities. And it's part. There are a couple reasons. One, in terms of dementia, that part of the brain that manages music is less affected generally wow. than, per se, the language center. So you and music also uses both sides of the brain so that you have more resources kind of going to it as your brain power is being compromised. And so that's why you'll find with music, as people go along, eventually they may lose the words, but they can still sing the melodies. You know, that's the
yeah.
last kind of aspect to go. My dad's at that point now where it's kind of heartbreaking to me that very few of the words are coming out for him, but the melodies are still very intense. In terms of your question about using it throughout the day, I love this topic. It's near and dear to my heart. And I have mm-hmm. a video on that on YouTube about ways that caregivers can incorporate music throughout the day. Some of the things you do, as you said, I think of it as creating a soundtrack for the day. So you okay. use music as a tool. If you have a hard time getting your loved ones out of bed in the morning, getting them to wake up, and this often happens with dementia, you know, it's the transitions are really difficult. And that can be true even for other issues, too, if you had a stroke or if you just have a lot of pain in the morning. So using music, there's a principle in music therapy where you match where the person is. So I have an iPad that's exclusively really for my dad's use for music. And we set it up so I may play a Pandora station or an iHeartRadio or a Amazon Prime. You know, there are a lot of tools you can use now. And I try to match. So if he wakes up groggy and really hard and we're trying to wake him up, I'm going to play quieter, more classical or calming music. And that kind of matches that. And then gradually you change it over to your desired mood. So if I'm trying to get him to wake up, I'm going to match where he is first. And then eventually I'm going to put it a little bit more peppier music and eventually work it up to something that he likes and that would be more like maybe big band music or that kind of thing.
Yeah.
So that's one way to use it.
Are you creating a playlist that you can just – you know, hit that whenever you determine what the mood is?
I don't actually do that because I need to – a playlist you mean in terms of starting at this and then the songs change
yeah.
over time?
Yeah.
I haven't
yeah.
done that, partially because I can never predict how long it's going to take, you know, and I have
mm-hmm.
to really watch him and get to watch the signals and then adjust according to his mood and how quickly he's waking up. It might be that he wakes up in 5 minutes or it might be he wakes up in half an hour. So I instead create stations in using these apps that I know are that. So, for example, I might have a classical station I've created. Like there's one I created on Pandora called Classical for the Soul, I think. And that's more, you know, the waking up or the calming down at night when we want to get him to calm down, you know, we can go in the opposite direction. And then I have
yeah.
created quite a few sort of 40s music or big band music and sing-along songs. We had a Mitch Miller. Hey, you remember Sing Along with Mitch Miller?
Yes.
That was when
yes.
we were kids, we had that album.
Yes.
Well, there are a lot of good songs that my dad knows. So I've created a station of that kind of music. And, you know, and right now, Christmas music, we're listening to a lot of Christmas music. So you can do an instrumental Christmas that's more calming, or you can do something like traditional Christmas songs, and then that's going to be more peppy. So I tend to create stations or play, you know, kind of playlists in a genre and then switch between them as needed.
Okay. That's really interesting.
Yeah.
So how do you introduce the music, though? Do you just, when you see that he's waking up, you just press a button and it starts
turn
to
it
play?
On.
Or do
yeah,
you...
absolutely. Yeah, we have speakers. And in fact, I also use it to help him sleep. So I think broadly of music in terms of sounds. So I play a Forest Rain app during the night that helps him stay, mm-hmm. sleep more better. I have a meditation app that he listens to as he goes to sleep, and that has some little bit of music in it. And he goes to sleep really well now and sleeps
that's
pretty
right.
well through the night. And so that's always there. So in the morning when we go in and we turn on the lights or open the curtains and start to get him to wake up, the music goes on. So it's just... It really is kind of like a background music. We really have music going all day in one form or another. Another way to do it is you're going to watch television, and Lawrence Welk is our very best friend because it's music that's recognizable. My parents did enjoy watching it in their later years, and originally we would DVR it because the local PBS station has Lawrence Welk every Saturday night. Now we have a smart TV where you can go on YouTube, and there are numerous episodes of Lawrence Welk that you can watch, and and I think there may be some on Netflix as well. So that is another way of turning downtime into something that's more productive. So, for example, Dad likes to, if he wants to sit and kind of not do anything for a while, we can still have the music on, and I have headphones for him that go directly from the television to his ears, which helps a lot too. Kind of with dementia, all the distractions are very difficult, so that really helps a lot. Also, we just sing, and you have to know you're the person you're caring for. My dad was involved in theater and music in our whole lives, and so it's always been a big part of our life. So when I would go for walks with him, we would sing. And I sort of started making that a thing because while physically exercising, it helps his brain power somehow. He'd be more sharp. So we would do math problems while we were walking and walk in the rhythm. And I do 2 + 2 = and he would say 4. And and then we would sing songs. And in the past 8 years, it's been kind of fun because, previously he would come up with songs that I didn't even know he know about, his college songs and things like that. So now I know all those songs, and as his skills are he's much more advanced now in Alzheimer's, we still sing those songs. And what I found as his abilities change and his walking abilities, et cetera, changed, then he can walk it with a more even gait if we're singing a marching song. So he was in the military, World War II, so that goes back, like you say, that long-term, deeply ingrained memory. So we sing, military marching songs, and we sing It's a Long Way to Tipperary, and we sing Jingle Bells and all those things to get him to walk in an even rhythm. And we sing his high school fight song and even his elementary school song, which I know, we still, and these things are still familiar to him. That can change, that helps actually get him going. We have a certain song we always sing when it's time to go get ready for bed. Show me the way to go home, if you know that song. I'm tired and I want to go to bed. And so that's a routine, and routine is very important, for everyone, especially as we get older, but especially in terms of caring for someone with dementia. So I set that up years ago so that as we've moved forward and dementia has progressed, those things are familiar. He gets those signals. There's something in there that helps to know where we're going, what we're doing. So just find different
that's
ways
right.
to do that. And as you, with an instrument, you brought up, if they used to play an instrument. Again, you just introduce it as something fun to do. Hey, you used to play the guitar. Let's get it out. Let's try it again. You don't want to push too much, but you keep offering it. Or maybe what you do is you take some guitar lessons and have him help you. Then it seems, natural that he's helping out and he's got a role that's important. But what your real goal is to try to get him to play.
Well, I play piano, so it'd be awfully hard to drag that around. So
that's true. I do too. But you can get a little keyboard, or he can play guitar and you can play piano and you play things together.
There you go. That sounds like a lot of fun. I have to think more about one thing. I know that we do Monday through Friday and sometimes on the weekends is make sure we're there in front of the television for Wheel of Fortune and Jeopardy.
Because that's really great.
Yes, it's a challenge for him and he loves it.
And yes, every once in a while, brain stimulated.
Yes, and if I'm out in the kitchen and I can hear it and he knows an answer, he screams it so loud. And it's just, yay, I got one. Yay.
Yay. And you reinforce that, I hope, and say, yay, you. And
I said, nice job. Nice job. So that I love to do that every night because it forces him to really get engaged in something that really, pushes his memory and makes him makes the parts of the brain connect there and come up with the answers, especially from Wheel of Fortune. Because, you know, you get certain letters and then you have to make up the word. So
it's a great challenge. And then, you know, I'm sure there are games that you can buy that use those same skills. So I'm sure there's a Wheel of Fortune game and there's probably a Jeopardy game and things that you could do with him at the same time.
Yep, I think he'd like that. So that's maybe going to be his Christmas present.
That's a great idea. Really great.
It serves him. I like it. That's a good thing. Let me go to another topic here because we've got a little bit more time, not much, but I want to see how you got involved in the multi-generational aspect and grandparenting. How is that something that people need to know about? I mean, I think most people think parenting is something you just learn about because you have a child. But grandparenting, I think most of us, because of the difference in the generations, have certain types of ideals of what it means to be a good parent and very often run into issues with our children who are parenting. And you would want to naturally just react to things a certain way because it worked for you and when you were child rearing. And yet that next generation doesn't buy it. So how do you get over the conflicts of grandparenting?
That is a tricky one. And these family dynamics come into play with all of these situations. You know, it comes up a lot with caregiving as well. And and with grandparenting, as you say, you know, the role of grandparents has changed over time. Current day grandparents are more active and living longer, and it's kind of in a different life stage. You know, 90% of grandparents say it's a very important role in their life. But at the same time, one of the top roles that they feel a grandparent should do is spoil their grandchildren. I mean, that's what you're supposed to do as a grandparent, right? As well as share family history and maybe help financially with some aspects of their education and that sort of thing. And all the research that AARP has done over the years indicates that those are the things that happen. But, you know, when you have that kind of conflict with grandparents and parents, it can be very tricky because I always say the most important person in the grandparent-grandchild relationship is the parent. It's not even, you know, it's not even the grandparent or the child. It's the person in between. And that's because the person in between is the parent is the one who facilitates the relationship. So if parents feel that you're spoiling their children too much, you're not respecting their rules, you're not enforcing the discipline that they believe in, or they feel like you're criticizing their parenting skills, then that's going to hurt your relationship with your grandchild. So, you know, think about, you know, you have to nurture your relationship with the adult children in order to have a good relationship with the grandchildren, if that makes sense.
It does. It does.
And you know, you have to look at it the other way, too. So all you parents out there, there is nothing better for a child than to have one-on-one relationships with adults who love them and care for them and will support them. So it's important for them to have relationships with across the generations. It's natural. It's the way it's supposed to be. So it's important as parents to allow that relationship to develop, to encourage it, support it. But I also hear from parents who are frustrated because their parents are too busy to spend time with their grandchildren. So it goes both ways.
It does. And I think that what makes it even harder to be in that role, again, is that same thing we talked about earlier, of the long distance between grandparents and grandchildren. And then I think another piece of it that's so hard is to watch when their children divorce and their grandchildren are out of their lives, out of their grandparents' lives, and how hard that is. But I understand that there's legislation now giving grandparents rights to visit with their grandchildren that didn't even exist a generation ago. Have you seen that?
That's actually an interesting topic. And with a lot of the work I did at grandparents at AARP, because we do have grandparents across the country who can't see their grandchildren and can't develop relationships with them, and that's heartbreaking for them. Yeah. And, you know, the parents have, you know, a right to make those decisions, but in the case of a non-intact family, it changes things. So there are some states in which, you know, they have some laws on the books about how these cases should be approached. You know, I believe it's, and AARP believes that it's most important that it be whatever's in the best interest of the child. And if that's the standard being used versus what we call the harm standard, some of the laws say, well, you have to prove that it will harm the child if they don't have a relationship with their grandparent. And that's a very different thing to prove and more difficult
to
prove.
It sure is.
So the laws vary from state to state. They change rapidly depending on court cases that come up. And it's generally never easy for grandparents to get visitation rights if they end up going to court, because it is an adversarial situation. So I recommend try to do mediation first, because that's much less, you know, acrimonial. It's very more of a human interaction and getting someone to help come up with an arrangement that everyone can live with. And you know, you will cost a lot less, too, than going to court.
And what about the role of grandparents now as primary caregivers for their grandchildren? That's not new. In a lot of cultural situations, that is the norm. But given that is now happening, especially in relationship to drug addiction and alcohol addiction, how do grandparents as primary caregivers function, I guess is the word? You know, where do you draw the line between what the parents were allowing or not allowing their children and what the grandparents would want to allow for their grandchildren?
Mm-hmm. Well, if you're talking about in a situation where the grandparent steps in and they are the primary caregiver, the grandchild is living with them, there's close to 3 million children who live in their homes where the grandparents are the householders, and close to 8 million if with other relatives and grandparents like aunts and uncles, et cetera. And there's close to 3 million grandparents who are in that situation. You know, they tend to have a lot of difficulty because children are in this situation, usually not for a good reason. It may be as severe as a parent is incarcerated or is addicted to drug or alcohol, has mental illness issues. It may be because parents divorced, and in some situations, you know, maybe the mother will move in with her parents with the children, and it's a multi-generational household. That can cause a lot of issues, as we discussed, in terms of who's in charge and what are the rules and where the discipline. When the parent is absent from the home, when it's just the grandparents and the grandchildren, it's tricky, too, because you don't get to play that traditional grandparent role. That's spoiling the grandkids, you know, and then send them home. You are essentially parenting them. And that can be really tricky. Sometimes the parent comes in and out of their lives, and that can be almost more difficult because they come in, they make promises, they treat the kids a certain way, and then they're gone. And the grandparents are there to kind of step, you know, put things back together again, as it were.
And is there something in the AARP.org/grandparents that can help with some of this?
Yes, we used to have a lot more information for grandparents. When I left, the Grandparent Information Center kind of didn't continue, but I have written a great deal on the website for that topic. I'm trying to remember here what the actual URL is. But I wrote a guide for grand families with which has several parts to it, covering, you know, everything from financial to education and family relationships and that sort of thing. So you can look there and have a lot of good referrals. It's also really important to check in with a grandfamilies.org, which is a partnership with American Bar Association, Generations United, and we have state fact sheets there that AARP and a number of other organizations have gone together, and we've done these for many years to keep them updated. So if you're living in a certain state and you're raising a grandchild, go there, find your state fact sheet, because that will tell you who to contact locally, where the grandparent support groups are, what are the child welfare issues, what are the laws in your state that are important to you.
That's great stuff. Really good, because I'm sure people are writing that down as you're speaking it. So unfortunately, we ran out of time here. So my thanks, and there's so much more I could have asked, but my thanks to my guest, Amy Goyer. And Amy, tell people how they can get in touch with you if they have additional questions or comments.
Absolutely. You can follow me on Twitter. It's just at Amy Goyer, and you feel free to send me a message there or tweet me something to if you have a question. And also on Facebook, I'm at facebook.com/AmyGoyer and the number one. And you can like my page there, and then you can send me messages there as well. And I do try to share a lot of help for caregivers and grandparents and these family relationships as we age.
Sounds wonderful. Okay. I think I need you in my back pocket. That's the way.
I know. Well, you contact me anytime if you need to talk something through. I really do think that as caregivers, we learn the most from each other, and I love being able to help people or send them to a resource that is helpful.
Thank you for that. I really appreciate it. So to all of you in my Power of the Purse community, I hope today's podcast was helpful in enriching your understanding of important financial matters and how some knowledge of money can go a long way to easing the burdens of life. If you would like to spend 15 minutes on a call with me and ask me questions about your personal finances, please go to my website, powerofthepursepodcast.com, select the contact tab, and find the time that works for you. And thanks again, Amy Goyer, for sharing your time and your knowledge. And until the next time, thanks for listening. And remember, money is not the enemy. Your ignorance of it is. Goodbye for now.
Thanks again, and join us next time to explore more ways you can take control of your finances and your life.